Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, January 6th, 2020. A freed South Sudanese activist vows to continue advocating for change in his country.
My work is to ensure that this country live in peace and that this country is stable and this country is moving forward. That this country is a place that can reward the million of martyrs that sacrificed their life for it.
And Sudanese women demand an end to discrimination.
Women can still be flogged, be persecuted for adultery. Women can still be stoned. The articles about invasion of privacy are still active. The articles of indecency and controlling women's dress code and presence in the public space is still there.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudanese scholar and activist freed from prison over the weekend by a presidential pardon says he will continue to advocate for peace in South Sudan. Peter Bier Ajak says he was detained under what he called extremely harsh conditions by the South Sudan National Security and Intelligence Service. He said his conditions improved after he was moved to Juba Central Prison. Manyang David Mayer reports for VOA from Juba.
Relatives of Peter Biar and businessman Carbino Wall celebrated at the gates of Juba Central Prison on Saturday as the two men emerged from prison gates as free men. Biar says he is glad to be out after being held by authorities since June 2018.
Because this is an end of a two-year period that has been extremely painful for myself and for my entire family. So I feel relief, and I'm sure also my family, they feel relief. And the fact that it has happened at the beginning of the year, we are hopeful about what the new year will bring.
Biar spent about a year at the South Sudan National Security Service Detention Facility, commonly known as Blue House, before being transferred to Juba Central Prison.
It was extremely harsh, particularly at the National Security Detention. Is beyond what I could describe. But since we arrived here at the Juba Central Prison, our treatment has been extremely great. And for that, we are grateful to the leadership of South Sudan Prison Services. But the time we spent at the National Security was very difficult.
Biar, head of South Sudan Young Leaders Forum, has been advocating for a peaceful resolution of the country's conflict. Biar says he is determined to resume his work and help make South Sudan a stable country.
My work is to ensure that this country live in peace and that this country is stable and this country is moving forward. That this country is a place that can reward the million of martyrs that sacrificed their life for it.
Biar says his immediate plans are to improve his health.
Because for the last year and a half, I have been without a proper medical attention. And now that I'm free, that is one of my first priorities. And then also to meet my family, meet my wife and my children, and miss them extremely, very, 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 very seriously.
Peter Biar's father, Ajak Ding, says he's feeling very happy.
They say that the government do arrest you and the government can release you. And I'm thankful today and I'm very happy. And it is a good beginning to my family, a good beginning of New Year. To my family.
Several human rights defenders and members of the international community, including U.S. members of Congress, condemned Biar's conviction, as well as that of businessman Carbino Wall. U.S. Congresswoman Magdalene Dean said on the floor of a U.S. House of Representatives in February last year that Biar would go free immediately. For VOA News, I am Manyang David Mayer. In Juba.
Civil society activists in Juba welcomed the release of Peter Biar 6 months after they were sentenced to years in prison for allegedly staging an uprising at the Blue House. The head of one group that monitors government activities says activists were afraid to speak when Biar was arrested. Lasoba Memo has more for VOA from Juba.
Peace activist and scholar Peter Biar and businessman Carbino Wall were among 30 inmates pardoned by President Salva Kiir last Thursday. They were released to their families on Saturday after their official paperwork was completed at the Juba Central Prison known as Kobar. Both men were sentenced to prison by the South Sudan High Court in July 2019. Biar was supposed to serve 2 years for inciting an uprising while under detention at South Sudan's National Security Service headquarters, commonly known as Blue House. Wall was sentenced to a total of 13 years in prison for leading the uprising. Four other men received five-year sentences for their role in the uprising. Rajab Mohandis, Executive Director for Organization for Responsive Governance, says Biar's and Wall's release was overdue, but says he is glad the two were freed.
We have been calling for their release all along, and it has finally happened. And we were happy about this release, but we feel that this is something our country should look at quite carefully, especially in terms of detention of people for simply speaking out their minds. Peter Biara Jack specifically, we feel that he got implicated into all this because of his vocal activism on the issues of this country.
The 34-year-old Ajak, who worked as an economist for the World Bank, was detained in July 2018 after criticizing the government and the opposition for failing to end the conflict. Mohandis says Biar was charged with causing public disorder after protesting his detention at the Blue House.
We were not so convinced of the entire process, the judicial process and so on, in terms of its fairness and so on, and in terms of even the case that was brought against them, the long detention without charges and so on. And our belief is that his case was associated strongly with his criticism of the situation in our country.
Mohandis says Biar's sentencing in particular created panic among civil society activists who feared the Kiir administration was targeting people seen as critical of government policies.
They fear that when people speak out, people will expose some of these things, like the abuses that they went through and some of the unbearable situations that they got subjected to. And people would criticize them in what they have been doing and so on. And because of that, they try to limit people's voices from criticizing them and also exposing some of the weaknesses.
Geoffrey Victor, Executive Director for Justice and Human Rights Observatory, an organization providing legal aid to inmates across South Sudan, also embraced President Kiir's decision to pardon the two men. He says releasing Biar and Wall has resolved some of the mistakes made by government officials.
If any of his subordinates or any of the people under him might have done a mistake, he has resolved the mistakes by addressing justice, by pardoning these people. To me, I see it that it is a justice that out and they are being pardoned.
The 30 inmates pardoned were held at Juba Central Prison, while Tonj, Kwajok and Torit State prisons. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
Some South Sudanese living with disabilities say they feel isolated and their rights are not respected. People using wheelchairs say it's difficult to access most buildings in Juba, which they say have no staircases. Ding Magod has more for VOA from Juba.
30-year-old Kathleen Vicencio has been visually impaired since she was 7 years old. Vicencio is an advocacy officer for the local NGO community-based inclusive development.
The environment is not accessible for persons with disabilities, especially me. When I want to pass by the road, you know, the road is not accessible. Even some of the sectors is not accessible. And it is really a very big challenge for me within the society.
30-year-old Abraham Majak Mayom is a disability inclusion facilitator at the National Education Ministry in Juba. He has been disabled since 1992. Mayom says while many people with disabilities are capable of working, it's hard for them to find jobs. As a refugee in Kenya, he taught in various schools for 17 years, but he says it has been difficult as a person with disabilities, to secure a permanent job in South Sudan.
We don't have employment. We don't have family support. Disabled people in South Sudan, they are the poor people, they are the last people. Because disability is caused by poverty. Poverty. You see, the challenge of South Sudan now is poverty. And you know, disabled people are not working. They cannot support themselves.
Gender and Social Welfare Minister Gemma Nunukumba says her ministry drafted a disability and inclusion policy in 2016, which Parliament has yet to approve.
Persons with disabilities are face difficulties in accessing education, health and sports facilities, places of work, elections, polling centers, information and other physical infrastructure, as well as productive resources. They are often denied access to most buildings, such as schools, hospitals, courts of law, etc. This is due to the fact that many buildings in South Sudan do not have facilities such as ramps and lifts.
Kumba says the draft policy identifies the obstacles and barriers to accessibility in buildings, roads, transport, and other facilities, including housing and medical buildings. The UK ambassador to Juba, Chris Trott, says South Sudan cannot eradicate poverty without ratifying the UN Convention and including people living with disabilities in the development process.
Disability inclusion is a priority for the United Kingdom. We will not eradicate poverty, deliver sustainable development goals, or implement the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities without including people with disabilities in our work.
AJSN works with the International Committee of the Red Cross as a program manager at the South Sudan Physical Rehabilitation Center. He says the center provides physiotherapy and mobility devices, including prosthetics and wheelchairs, which has changed attitudes towards people with disability.
Except I said no one is giving. And then access to these services. Many people in this country, disabled, they could be benefited from this service we provided, but they don't know. Even they know, they don't have means to come to the center. And even they have means, the transportation system is so poor, they cannot travel.
Sen says the stigma attached to people with disabilities is still a big problem in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Ding Magot in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Sudanese women demand for change. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Tell me about your favorite person.
My favorite person is my best friend. I've been best friends since when we're children and we've grown up. We are in tertiary level and we are still very close and good friends.
My favorite person is my friend. And she's a lady who really knows her worth. She knows her values. She stands for her values and all. She doesn't compromise.
My mom is my favorite person. She inspires me. She gives me the courage to do anything that I want.
Me, I'm a fan of basketball. I play basketball. And the person I like and impresses me too much is LeBron James. I follow him so much and I like his game.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. A women's rights activist is calling on Sudan's transitional government to ratify the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women so that Sudanese women can fully engage in nation-building process. Michael Atid has more for VOA from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
Hala Al-Karbi, Regional Director for the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa, SIHA, says Sudanese women are discriminated against in the society because the former regime of Omar al-Bashir was not friendly to women. Al-Karbi says, although the transitional government lifted the controversial Public Order Act, certain provisions in the Criminal Act are still being used against women in Sudan.
Women can still be flogged, women can still be persecuted for adultery, women can still be stoned. The articles about invasion of privacy are still active. The articles of indecency and controlling women dress code and presence in the public spaces is still there.
The more than 20-year-old Public Order Act was lifted by the transitional government in late November. Al-Karbi says Sudanese women were leading the revolution, but nothing was given to them in return. She says female genital mutilation, or FGM, and early marriages are still being practiced across the country.
Young girl as of age 10 can be wedded off, can be married by the guardians. Women can still, they need their guardians to produce birth certificates. You know, our policies is completely still based on the former regime. Ideology.
Al-Karbi says she believes ratifying the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women will enable Sudanese women to have more access to job opportunities and education, which will contribute to the nation building.
You know, if you look at the conditions of our curriculum, it is extremely discriminatory. You know, if you look at the conditions of our, you know, labor laws, for example, we don't have any harassment laws. Women cannot go to a police station and report on sexual violence and sexual harassment because we have one of the worst laws when it comes to sexual violence and sexual harassment.
Women rights activists say they will continue to engage the country's relevant institutions until the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women is ratified. Al-Karbi says a coalition of more than 10 Sudanese women groups have signed a petition addressed to the office of the Prime Minister, Abdallah Hamdok, asking him to include the issue of the changing laws about women in the next cabinet meeting.
We expect a fundamental changes into Sudan legal framework, and we expect a fundamental change in Sudan system of governance where equality and justice will be actually part of the system.
Six countries, including Sudan, have not ratified the Convention to the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. The others are the United States, Iran, Somalia, Palau, and Tonga. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. One U.S. service member and two contractors with the U.S. Department of Defense were killed after Al-Shabaab extremists overran a key military base used by U.S. counter-terror forces in Kenya over the weekend. The U.S. Africa Command issued a statement last night saying the militants destroyed several U.S. aircraft and vehicles before they were repelled. The Al-Shabaab attack came days after a U.S. airstrike killed Iran's top military commander. George Musalemi, a Kenyan security consultant, says he does not think there is a connection between the two because it appears the militants planned their attack a while ago.
The latest is that the State Department of Defense has confirmed that we have one American serviceman and two Department of Defense contractors that were killed in the Manda attack. The attack was largely repulsed, but the fact that we have casualties clearly shows that there was a lot of planning and coordination in the attack that was carried out by the Al-Shabaab.
I know that Kenya has had its problems with Al-Shabaab. This attack is coming on the heels of the U.S. attack or the killing of the commander of the Iraqi forces there. So is there any connection here with what happened in Kenya and the killing of the Iraqi commander?
I'm not seeing any connection from experience, this kind of an attack. And if you look at the magnitude of the attack, it clearly shows it took a lot of planning and a lot of resources. So this is not something that was planned yesterday after the killing of the Iran commander by the Americans. Probably it might have catalyzed the attack, but I don't think it's anything related to this. This is something that was planned for a long time. I think that it's a coincidence that it came closely after the killing of the Iranian attack by the Americans. So I'm not seeing any relationship, though people are trying to put a relationship there. But from my end, if I look at the way terror attacks are planned and carried out, it could not have come very quickly like it has happened. And then the magnitude of the attack itself also shows that there was a lot of planning that was carried out before this attack was done.
I know that the Al-Shabaab has its beef with the Kenyan military because of Kenya's involvement in Somalia. So do you think they are going after Kenya or they are going after the Americans?
Basically, they are going for both Kenya and the Americans because Kenya and the Americans have been partners in the war against Al-Shabaab. Remember, so many of Al-Shabaab commanders have been killed by drones that are operated by the Americans. So clearly, carrying this attack at a joint camp that is managed by the Kenyans and the Americans clearly shows that they are trying to show that you Americans have joined Kenya in fighting us. So basically, you also have to suffer the consequences. So I think that it's an indication that very soon we need to beef up security in all international installations within our boundaries, because now Al-Shabaab are not only targeting Kenyan concerns, but they're also looking at the partners that Kenya is working with in fighting them.
I read somewhere where I think it said that Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility. What is the Kenyan government saying? Well, first of all, let me say, what is Al-Shabaab saying?
Al-Shabaab have claimed responsibility, and that is as far as they have gone. And on the other end, the Kenyan government has also given a statement that this attack actually was carried out, and the Kenyan government is saying that the attackers were repulsed and several terrorists killed. That is as far as they have said, but they say that security along the Kenyan-Somali border in Lamu has been beefed up. So we are expecting more action, to see more action by the Kenyan Defense Forces in the areas around Lamu and Manda Island.
That was George Musalemi, a Kenyan security consultant, speaking with my colleague James Batty from Nairobi. In Lamu County, the coastal region of Kenya, some civilians are moving out of their homes into small towns for safety. The development comes a day after the Al-Shabaab militant group stormed a military base that hosts U.S. and Kenyan counter-terrorism forces, killing three U.S. personnel. Muhammad Yusuf has the story for VOA from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Witnesses say people are moving out of villages near the Manda Bay airfield for fear of further attacks or getting caught in clashes between security forces and Al-Shabaab fighters hiding in the nearby Boni Forest. Anab Haji is a member of the County Assembly of Lamu. Her constituency falls under the area that came under attack.
Yeah, people are in fear, actually. And people have been moving from their village to the nearby town, that is Hindi and Mokoe. They're moving from their village. You know, we have villages like places like Mkondoni. You have Sinambio, Kausara. So people have been in fear. That's why they are leaving, going to town. Yeah, they are afraid, yeah. But security is very tight. Our people, the militaries are doing a very good job.
On Sunday, Al-Shabaab militants stormed the base, damaging several aircraft and vehicles before they were driven out by the American and Kenyan forces. The U.S. Africa Command, in a statement, said the three men killed were an American serviceman and two contractors. Two more contractors were wounded, and they were in a stable condition. One man who lived close to the camp moved to Hindi Town, which is about 5 kilometers from the base, for safety.
If watu wanaweza enda kwa kambi kubwa kama ile,
if people can attack such a military camp that of powerful country, what about ordinary people like us who just walk with nothing? He says there are security officers present, but these people know officers are there and they are still coming, so you can't know. You don't want to take risk, want to be caught between the officers and militiamen. Since the attack Sunday morning, Kenya has beefed up security in and around Lamu County, which borders Somalia. Security analyst Abdullahi Halake told VOA that Al-Shabaab is trying to exploit political developments in the Horn of Africa, including the upcoming Somalia election.
There's no good relationship between Mogadishu and Nairobi. And Al-Shabaab is now taking advantage of all that. Election is this year. Kenya and Somalia do not enjoy a good relationship. AMISOM winding down is, if everything goes as planned, this year. So all these things are brought together, and Al-Shabaab is taking advantage of that. And my sense is we might be able to see some of these attacks probably increasing.
Al-Shabaab has carried out frequent terror attacks in Kenya since 2011, when Kenya sent soldiers to Somalia to fight Al-Shabaab. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
That's our show for this Monday, and we leave you with the song Kelele by Hardlife Avenue Stars. We've been listening to Hardline Avenue Stars with the song Kelele. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being here. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.